Started
Okay.
here. Hey, you guys, welcome back to Tell Me Why You're Special with your favorite podcast host, Brandon Lynette. This is the show where we kind of skip that polished highlight reel era, and I really just want to get to the straight truth about what actually shapes people. So every single one of us is in the arena. Some people are building something, some people are getting knocked around by life, some people are bleeding and figuring out as they go. But the people who actually matter are the ones who end up changing things. They're the ones who stay in the arena long enough to turn their mess into their message, and that's what the show is about, okay? Real stories behind the real people who've actually lived through the things, the failures, the lessons, the scars. And what makes them special is something we all have in common, and I'm always excited to find out what that is, okay? So everybody that gets here is in the hot seat immediately, and my next guest is no different, but I'm sure this is not intimidating to him because he's been around a lot scarier things. So, listen, it's not because, anybody's better than anybody else, but there is something in our lives that gives us like that perspective that we can learn from, okay? Today's guest definitely fits that description. I have Eric Hommel, born and raised in New York City, and he's not there anymore in case, but we'll get to the story of that. Incredible service to our country. So first of all, I just want to say thank you for your service. I don't want to tell your whole story here, so I'm not going to continue to just embellish and go for all the things. I want you to tell us who you are. So, Eric, welcome to the show today.
Thank you. It's great
Yeah.
to be here, Brandon.
Yeah. You, I can already tell, like, what makes your story extra powerful is that you chose to do something that most people in leadership don't do, and that's taking ownership. And I am just my listeners are like, oh my gosh, personal responsibility, she's all about it. So I'm very excited to talk about that. I do want to talk about your memoir, The Losing Game. Just I know this is going to be your first person account of everything that kind of happened in an Afghanistan mission. So outside of that, Eric, you are in the hot seat. Why don't you introduce yourself to everybody, kind of give us your elevator pitch to get started?
Okay, my quick elevator pitch.
Yeah.
I'm a veteran. I'm an author of The Losing Game, How to Lose a War and Fail Veterans. It's a romantic comedy, as you could tell. And as by definition, I am a loser.
Yeah.
That's my introduction.
That's fabulous. And then, I mean, everyone's intrigued now because you served in multiple branches of the military. Okay. So that part, I'm like, that's kind of incredible. First of all, what's your origin story for joining?
Failure. Yeah, so I have a history of failure. So born and raised in New York City, I went to a specialized high school in Manhattan called High School of Art and Design, where I had a
Fancy.
major, architecture. Didn't like it by the end of it, and so I tried college for a year, failed at that, joined the Navy, wound up on a fast attack submarine during the Cold War,
What?
which I don't recommend to anybody, by the way. Yeah. So from the Navy, did one enlistment, active enlistment. I had a reserve commitment, went back to school. Some undergrad is a fine arts degree in historic preservation. So back into the building arts, but not architecture.
Okay.
From there, off to grad school for city and regional planning, stayed in the Navy Reserve. And it was in grad school that a soldier convinced me to join the Air Force.
Wow.
He said the magic words. He said, "Do you ever see the way those guys live?"
Yeah.
Okay, so just for your benefit and for your listeners, in the Army and the Marines, when you spend the night somewhere, you dig in, right? You're sleeping in the ground. In the Air Force, we check in.
Fancy.
That's right. We realize there are these things called hotels.
Yeah. No, that is amazing, and that's
So got my commission in the Air Force, 3 years up in North Dakota, and then the Air Force sent me to DC. Back in 98, number of jobs, reported eventually to the Pentagon July 2001,
okay.
and spent 10 years attached to the building to the Pentagon. So obviously that's 2 months before September 11th.
Yeah.
In the Pentagon, eventually I would deploy to Iraq with the Army, even though I tried to avoid the Army as an Air Force guy. I was working with the Army in Iraq. Doing reconstruction. This was late 2004, early 2005. So that's the big battle in Fallujah, if you remember that. I know you're too young to remember it, so it's
Oh,
okay.
definitely not.
And so, yeah, we had $18.4 billion to rebuild Iraq, which is kind of tough when people are shooting at you. All right. And that's really when I saw it in the Pentagon. I saw after September 11th, I saw how we started to ad hoc address these wars. Okay. Because we didn't plan for these wars. Just again, for your benefit of you and your listeners, the current war in Iran. We've had that war plan on the shelf for years. Okay, this is nothing new. But Iraq and Afghanistan, or I should say Afghanistan first, Iraq, these are ad hoc planning situations. So I got to see it from day one inside the building. And so going to Iraq was an eye-opener because I got to see how leadership wanted to get things done overnight. And in a place like Iraq, you cannot get things done overnight. It's going to take at least one generation. Because you're dealing with people who want to hold onto power, and they're not willing to give that up. And then came back to D.C., back to the Pentagon. Eventually, 3 years up on Capitol Hill as a legislative liaison. So I worked on the House side. Each service has a small group of people physically working up on Capitol Hill, and our job is kind of be the connective tissue between the Pentagon and Congress. So to make sure that nobody gets super stupid. Right. Yeah. Right.
That
Okay.
makes sense.
So, but between the Pentagon, between Congress, I get to peel back the curtain a little bit more and see how things are working. In Congress, I supported the NATO Parliamentary Assembly. So that's the political arm of NATO. Afghanistan is a NATO war because an attack on one is an attack on all. September 11th was an attack on the United States. All NATO countries now go and play in Afghanistan. So I got to see the war in Afghanistan from a political perspective before I deployed there. Again, with the Army, I was very fortunate. I was in an Army position as a ground battle space commander, which mean I had ownership of a province, like a state in Afghanistan, a province called Panjshir. I was also a provincial reconstruction team commander. So I had responsibility for reconstruction, governance, and security. Basically, what we're trying to do is build civil society, right, in Afghanistan. And we call this stability operations. That in turn will create a strong, stable, secure Afghanistan that are allies with the United States. That's how you win a war, okay, by securing the peace. And again, it takes about 30 years if you're doing it right, especially in those regions, okay, because.
I don't, I'm glad you're saying this stuff because I think a lot of people don't understand that.
Yes, and that is the main reason why I wrote the book. I actually wrote the book out of frustration. I never intended to write a book. But following the 2019, December 2019 publication of a book called The Afghanistan Papers by a Washington Post reporter by the name of Craig Whitlock. And the timing is really important, December 2019, because a couple months later, COVID happens. But what Whitlock in his book revealed was that senior leadership knew that we were losing in Afghanistan and they were lying. So, lying to Congress, lying to the American public, and so on. His quote, senior leaders were at war with the truth. And when I read his book, and also after I retired from the Air Force in 2011, I stayed on for the next decade training government officials to deploy to places like Afghanistan as advisors. Work in their Ministry of Defense, Ministry of Interior, that's the police, basically trying to work on governance. And so I was involved for many, many, many years. And so when Whitlock publishes his book, none of that surprised me, right? Because I knew we were losing and I knew we were lying. What really surprised me was the response from other officers who wrote editorials to the Washington Post saying, I knew, but not my fault. And the worst part was that the senior most leaders just stayed silent. Okay. And the best thing happened to all of them, you know, because never, you know, let a good tragedy go to waste. COVID happened and that went away. We got so focused on COVID that our failures in Afghanistan went away. And then, of course, August 2021 happens. We withdraw out of Afghanistan. I worked with the refugees, about 120,000 refugees coming to the United States.
Yeah.
Worked with them for about a year. And at that point, I was just so disgusted, I needed to get my thoughts on paper.
Yeah.
But now, with that said, some people find my book funny. So, you have to kind of work it all out, make it
Right.
readable. So, yeah. So, yeah, there's a lot going on in that book. I take you through the journey and I try to explain how to win a war by explaining the phases of warfare and why we elect not to go down that route.
Right.
And, bottom line is that we are destined to do this again because we haven't learned any lessons.
Yeah. And I mean, there's so many things I want to touch on that you were talking about. For one, silence is complicity. That is true to life across the board. So,
Especially when you're in a leadership position.
yes.
Especially.
So when you saw the beginning of these, like looking back, you're at the ground floor of a war that wasn't planned. Like, is that the moment that kind of shaped the way you see leadership the most, or is there something else that happened in that moment where that kind of took shape for you?
So obviously that was pretty profound, right? Because that's when the hammer hits the nail.
Right.
But no, my leadership journey started when I was a young enlisted kid on a submarine. Because when I was on a fast attack submarine, that was the Cold War.
Yeah.
Cold War was real. And we were the ones out there hunting Soviet ballistic missile submarines. So, we had a real job to do. And in addition to that, you also had another enemy called the Atlantic Ocean that really wanted to kill you.
Yeah.
And
Right.
so leadership mattered. And I had the good fortune of serving under two captains on the submarine. And I saw the dichotomy in leadership there. I saw that to be an effective leader in that type of situation, and again, this is all life and death, you have to care.
Yeah.
You have to care about the mission, and you have to care about the people who carry out the mission. That was my first captain, and we did rather well. And we were confident. Second captain comes along, crew remains the same, and overnight we go to crap.
Wow.
Why? Second captain, it was clear he only cared about himself.
Yeah.
It was about his career.
Right.
So he put himself before the mission and before the people. And it was awful. And so I've taken those leadership lessons from early on in my life as a 19-year-old, and just hopefully have pushed them forward.
Yeah.
And I talk about a lot of that in my book. And I mentioned, look, it's not that hard, but it is in concept, it's not hard. Can I curse on your podcast?
Oh, please. Yes.
Okay. All right. So I call it just give a shit.
Yeah.
Just give a shit. Okay. And so again, in concept, not difficult.
Right.
But in application, absolutely, because it's truly your core personality. You either care about your people and the mission, or you decide that I care about myself and my career, and then they'll just do what I tell them to do because they have to.
Yeah.
Right. And so, again, I've taken that throughout my career. September 11th, I was an aide de camp. So basically right-hand man to the general in charge of Air Force Reserve Command, about 75,000 airmen. It's a big command. And Air Force reservists were in the fight from day one. They were actually the first aircraft over Afghanistan after September 11th.
Okay.
And so I saw this man masterfully lead a command of 75,000 people
Wow.
because he cared.
He cared. Yeah.
Plain and simple. He knew people. He trusted people. He allowed them to do their jobs and it was not about this man's career. And then you see everything in between as you go along. And then, of course, when you actually get in country where the rubber meets the road, then you see some
You really,
amazing personalities.
yeah.
Yes.
Definitely that. I believe that's going to show you who you really are at your core. I can see that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it all goes back to that. And now let's take present day. We have so many leaders, and I use that term in quotes, who were responsible for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah.
And how come you never hear them talking about failure and how we need to learn from failure? Especially, how come you never hear them talking to the troops?
Yeah.
Okay. It's because the troops are, the guys and gals who are suffering
Right.
because they can't make sense of this. They did their job.
Yeah.
But the problem is they didn't understand the mission.
Right.
It's a big difference between your job and the mission. And now we're at a point where senior leaders, guys who are hammering paychecks on corporate boards, I've seen a couple of them on the news lately talking about, how to win a war in Iran, yet they've lost two in a row. But they're not talking to the vets. They're not talking to their troops because they don't give a shit.
Right.
And they're all multimillionaires.
Yeah.
How weird.
Yeah.
So they benefited from losing.
Yeah. No,
Sorry,
a
am I
lot of people did. No,
being
I love
stubborn?
that. The whole time you're talking, I'm like, I have him on the wrong show. Everybody, my audience knows I have a political podcast, and I'm like, man, I need him over there because what is the truth? What is the truth? You know?
Well, drag me across. I'm happy to go.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. No, but that's, I mean, that's exactly how it is. And I feel like, you know, especially on our side, I mean, the truth is coming out. You know, the billionaires are, we're useful idiots to all of them. Whether you're in the military, you're just an average Joe. So, you know, we've really been useful idiots, and a lot of people are complicit because they've been silent about it. And I think, you know, my mission is to make sure people are taking massive responsibility. Maybe not for on the grand scale, like I can't take responsibility for what happened at the war, right? But I can take responsibility for how I'm going to vote and how I'm going to continue to talk to people to wake them up to the truth that we're lied to 90% of the time. And even now is no different for me. We don't know what we don't know, you know? We
Exactly.
don't know what we don't know. And at the end of the day, the truth will come out eventually. And we'll all, you know, face palm our forehead. But at this point, it's just one of those, like, we just don't know what we don't know. But I mean, a lot of us, everybody that I know, like we see outside of the military, we only see wars through headlines.
Of
And that
course.
can't be believed either. So what is something that just even civilians are completely misunderstanding about modern warfare?
Well, a lot. And there's a lot that people in the military misunderstand about modern warfare. But you're absolutely right. We don't know what we don't know. Another reason why I wrote the book, I wanted to live a simple life. I wanted to be an architect until I didn't. I wanted to be a preservationist until my family situation and so on changed all that. Okay. I never wanted to be this guy, right? This was never, ever, ever what I set out to do.
Right.
I as an Air Force guy, was I going to get an army command in Afghanistan? No, that's unheard of, right? I care about Congress? No, the reason why I wanted to work for Congress is because I wanted to keep my family in this area, and the Air Force was getting ready to move me again, so I had to get in the business of DC. All right, so none of this really mattered to me in my life. Okay, again, I have a fine arts degree. Okay,
Yeah.
so what do we need to know about warfare that we don't need to know?
Yeah.
You do not win wars by killing people and breaking their things.
Right.
You win battles.
Yeah.
And oh, by the way, Brandon, we are the best at killing people and breaking their things.
Yeah. And we've
Okay.
bragged about that for
We are awesome. That's right. Okay. But again, that's not how you win wars.
Yeah.
And so, I was in the training business for 10 years after I retired from the military, again, training government officials. And by the way, my training was live, immersive, interactive theater.
Okay.
We recreated Iraq and Afghanistan in a little training location out in the woods of Indiana. And we had role players, we had actors. And it was, in my opinion, pretty amazing. The first time I saw it after coming back from Afghanistan, I was like, wow, I feel like I'm back. Okay. And the reason why I bring up that training is because I would ask government officials now, I would ask them, did we win World War I? A lot of them said yes.
Yeah.
So then the question then becomes, why did we have World War II?
Right.
right? Last time I checked, it was Germany and Germany, right? Okay. So following World War I, I would argue we did not secure the peace, right? We won the battles. We got Germany to a point where they said, okay, we give up. Treaty of Versailles. We tried to secure the peace, League of Nations, all those types of things. Didn't work. Matter of fact, we punished Germany, right? We mostly France and England. That led to the rise of Adolf Hitler, and the Nazis and so on. It's kind of a natural reaction, right?
Right.
You're going to subjugate us, we're going to rise. World War II, what's different? Did we win World War II? I would argue yes, mainly because of a man by the name of George C. Marshall.
Yeah.
George C. Marshall was chief of staff of the Army during World War II. Okay, five-star general. He was Eisenhower's boss in Europe and MacArthur's boss in the Pacific. Architect of World War II. Following World War II, he becomes Secretary of State. So now he's the top diplomat. He implements a thing called the Marshall Plan. All right. And that is the reconstruction of Europe and also some concentration on Japan as well. We are still in Europe. We are still in Japan. We have secured the peace. And the Marshall Plan was largely an economic stability plan. It's not about building infrastructure, which any dummy can do. Even I can do that. It's about getting the society to function in a manner where there's security, good governance, rule of law, socioeconomic development, right?
Yeah.
That's how you secure the peace. And that takes time. So for your listeners, how you win a war is you secure the peace. Everything up to that is you are winning battles.
Right.
Right? And so the business I was really in Afghanistan was the counterinsurgency business. It's the last three phases of warfare. First two phases, shape, like sending all those ships into the Gulf
Yeah.
prior to Iran. Then clear, that's killing people and breaking their things. That's what's going on currently in Iran. Then after that, you have to hold the environment in order to build not just infrastructure, but society and government, and then transition, giving it back to the rightful owner as allies. That's how you win a war. And
Well,
we suck at the last three.
I was just going to say, it doesn't look like we're very hopeful in the last three right now for anything that's happening currently either. So I kind of have a two-part question here, because why do you think our system struggles so much to take that responsibility when things fail? But also, is it partly to kind of protect the idea of the military? I mean, my son is signing up for the Marines in less than 8 weeks.
We'll talk.
Yeah, oh, trust me, there's no talking him out of it. He is set.
I'm not talking about him, but we'll talk.
Yeah. But so he's doing that, and I just think, like, I couldn't imagine parents that had kids at war that they lost. Like, it would break my heart to know it was for nothing and how much leadership failed and everybody screwed up, at least if I'm kind of in denial. So if they keep the public kind of in denial, that we've been manipulated this whole time psychologically, no matter what. So, do you think they kind of hesitate telling the truth just to kind of hold that integrity of the military? Because you also talk about helping veterans understand that bigger context of their missions. And I don't think leadership is going to be doing that, especially if we're losing. But I mean, that kind of stuff matters. And no matter how much we're failing our soldiers now and then, I mean, it's even worse for veterans. Like, we have really. The United States, it's embarrassing. Like, for everybody that has served, I'm embarrassed for this country for how much they've let you down. But two-part question, if it makes sense to you.
So what I got from you is, why do the systems fail? And do they lie on purpose? Is that basically
Kind of, yeah.
what
Like,
it is? Okay.
are they trying to, protect people because they don't want them to think that, their sons died in vain?
Well, they don't want to be embarrassed also, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so the system. So when President Eisenhower was leaving office in 1961, when JFK was elected, he got on TV and he talked about this thing called the military industrial complex. Okay, so here's a five-star general, now president of the United States, two-term president, saying, beware this thing called the military industrial complex. Okay, so we start talking about systems and system failure. The system doesn't fail as long as you understand that the system is designed to perpetuate the military-industrial complex.
Right.
And so the system is designed to get into, I'm looking for a book on my shelf here. It's called War is a Racket, written by a two-time Medal of Honor winner, Major General Smedley Butler, United States Marine Corps. He wrote a book called War is a Racket. Okay.
Okay.
But and so when you have a two-time Medal of Honor recipient write that type of book, you should listen.
Yeah.
But that's what it's all about. This is a money-making business. Okay. Look at where, again, the leaders who lost Iraq and Afghanistan, look where they are now. And they're working for the military-industrial complex. Okay. So does the system fail? No, because the system is designed to win. And in order for it to win, then it helps at failing at basically winning wars, securing the peace. If you have peace, there's no need for the military-industrial complex.
And a lot of people lose a lot of money.
Amen. Absolutely. I mean, even before the war in Iran, we were talking about $1 trillion Department of War budget for a country not at war.
Correct.
We have more general officers today than we did in World War II.
Right.
Okay. So, does that answer your question about the system?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And
And
it's like every other system, right? It protects itself, it's for itself,
course,
and
of
it's
course.
always going to be about itself.
And don't listen to these people who are in the system, tell you what the system does. Look at what it accomplishes.
Yeah.
And again, look at Iraq and Afghanistan, particularly Afghanistan. What did you accomplish?
Yeah.
Okay. So the proof is in the pudding, as they say. And your second question, do they lie on purpose?
Yeah,
Well,
we know they lie on purpose, but I mean,
a
do you think part of it is like if they came out and they were like, "Hey, your kids all died in vain because we did this, we dropped the bomb, we failed.
Yeah.
We didn't win." Like,
Yeah.
who's going to sign up for that?
Yeah. Who is going to sign up for that? That's a great question. So do they lie on purpose? Kind of, sort of.
Yeah.
But then again, so let me just back up a little bit. So the th last three phases of warfare, that hold, build, and transition, that's basically what we call stability operations. And by Department of War doctrine, we are supposed to conduct stability operations on the same level as combat operations. But I guarantee you that if you ask anybody in the military if they focused any training on stability operations, you're probably going to get a no or what's that?
Yeah.
Okay. Because the big focus, again, is on killing people and breaking their things.
Right.
That second phase of warfare. So do they lie on purpose? Well, if you're only focusing on that second phase and you don't know, again, the final three phases of warfare, is that a lie or is that just ignorance?
Omission, yeah.
And so, of course, I argue that learn your job,
Yeah.
okay? And also realize that building a school in Afghanistan doesn't teach children. You have to build teachers,
Right.
and that takes time. But we were using the building of schools as metrics
Right.
to show that we were winning because a school houses 200 children. So, of course, 200 children are being educated.
That's so smart.
By whom, right?
Wow.
So is it a lie? Is it ignorance? Is it a combination?
Yeah, it's kind of everything.
It's kind of everything.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, cheers to the government of the United States of America and our military.
Now, with that said,
Yeah.
I'm a patriot, okay? And
100%.
in that I love my country
Yes.
all the time, and I love my government when it deserves it.
When it deserves it, and it's been a minute.
Yep.
No,
And also keep in mind, I spent
wait,
4 years
hey,
up on Capitol Hill. I
yeah,
know
I'm
those
joking.
guys.
There's a lot of things that's happening in the government that I'm very happy about. So I'm not literal when I say that, but also like there's such a deep, dark, troubled system, and that's where my focus is now, is like, how do you just clean it? You would have to start all over. Like burn it all down, everybody gets fired and you start over. There's just no voting our way out of so much of the toxic stuff in the system. But anyway, I do agree some things are
Can I
worth it.
comment on that?
Yeah.
The way our founding fathers designed it, pretty awesome,
Right.
especially for the day. The problem with poli and keep in mind the military is civilian run, right? The Secretary of War is a civilian dude,
Yeah.
right? Okay, and that's by design,
Yeah.
because too powerful of a military can overtake a democratic government, and so that.
Right.
So the foundation is there. Unfortunately, we have a two-party system. I call it, political duopoly, like Coke and Pepsi,
Yep.
right? So I don't know. Are you familiar with RC Cola? Have
Yeah.
you ever? Yeah. Can you get it at McDonald's?
No.
Can you get it at Taco Bell?
I haven't seen it in like 20 years,
Right.
so I'm gonna say no.
Because the cola companies is a two-party system. It's a duopoly. Okay.
Correct.
And so they benefit each other.
Yeah.
And I think what we really need to do in this country is really start moving away from a political duopoly. And good luck, because again, you're going to be taking power,
Yeah.
and the Republicans and the Democrats will never, want to give up any power.
Right.
And then, of course, you have to look at the personalities that are attracted to politics. And again, I traveled the world with members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats.
Yeah.
I don't trust one of them.
Right.
Okay. They will talk a good game, but God forbid you cross them in any way,
You're done.
Democrat or Republican,
Yeah.
right? Don't fall for that. All right. It's okay. Think of the type of person that runs for public office. Think of the scrutiny, right? That, obviously they're going to suffer what their family goes through.
Right.
And then you look at this individual and you go, why do you want this?
Right.
All right. And so it's a special type of individual
Yeah.
that runs for public office. So I don't think we need to burn it all down,
Yeah.
but something's got to give. And I just want more choice. I want that RC Cola.
Right.
Legitimately, I
We
want that
sneak in
RC.
RC Cola every once in a while, but it doesn't get very far. Like, we
Right.
get them in somehow. Like, we get a little taste of it. But I totally agree with you. And as long as, like, we allow them to weaponize us against each other, so
Worst
the
possible
media,
thing, people.
yeah, media, all of it, like, we don't stand a chance. And, if big things can't unite us, like, we are, it's done. It's done. There's no point. And I want to get back to that common sense of exactly what the founding fathers did, and that was to help us create this country with that freedom where the government works for the people. Right now, how do we not have access to the government and what they do? Why is everything they do hidden? Like, everything they do should be on the books, and what I do should be private because they're supposed to work for me. But what has happened, and I think what is so toxic with the system, is that they have weaponized, like, the judicial system. They've weaponized Congress, and that all protects itself, just like our, fancy generals. They've all just learned to protect themselves, and it's unfortunate. But you guys, we are running out of time here, and so I want to ask this last question. What is one thing about your journey, this whole experience, that people rarely ask about, but it's something you think they should be asking you?
What they rarely ask about. Okay, so currently I'm out of government, and I give tours of Arlington National Cemetery.
Okay.
All right, because at one point in my life I was the officer in charge of Air Force ceremonies, so I was responsible for high level funerals up at Arlington. And I'm done with the government, don't want to play anymore, and so just hung my own shingle. And the reason why I mentioned that is I advertise, my tours are 3 hours long, pretty long.
Yeah.
And I make it clear to my guests, typically we go 4 hours, sometimes six, but I tell my guests right up front, wide open, over 400,000 stories in this cemetery, all punctuated by military decision making, politics, life, love, everything.
Yeah.
And eventually at the end, I tell them I wrote a book and all that. And I had somebody here recently ask me if I found any catharsis by writing the book.
Yeah.
And I never really got asked that. And I thought for a minute, and I wanted to say yes,
Yeah.
but I told them no, because it hasn't reached enough people, hasn't reached enough vets for them to understand that what they did mattered.
Right.
They did their jobs,
Yeah.
and leadership failed them because we did not explain the mission and we did not take responsibility.
Yeah.
And so, if when the vets start understanding that it's guys like me that failed them and are willing to say that we failed them
They
and
can
that it's
heal.
not on them at all, that's when I'll get some catharsis.
Yeah. Wow. That's an incredible place, Eric, for us to take the ending of this, because right now I'm telling you guys, you need to go into the show notes and get this book and send it to a veteran that you know. And you all know one. I think we all at least know one. But please share the show out so we can get his message out. Because what I think is super incredibly special about you, sir, is that you are standing up against a machine to tell the truth. You're doing what all leaders should have done, and that's taking massive responsibility for the ways that we failed. That's not easy to do. It's never going to be easy to admit the failures. So I kudos to you. I appreciate you so much for coming on the show and talking about this. And I feel like we're going to have another conversation soon for sure. So,
Thank you. It's been my pleasure. Thank you for this
yeah,
opportunity.
absolutely. And
And
you guys,
can I plug my business real quick?
yes, please do.
If anybody wants to come out to Arlington and spend 3, 4, 5, 6 hours with me walking around in the heat, I'm at vigilancetours.com, VIGILANCE TOURS. Thank you very
Awesome.
much.
I'll definitely link that in the show notes as well, you guys. So, but yeah, that's what the show is all about. Real people, real stories, real lessons that come from being willing to step in the arena, even if you're rebelling against the machine, and to live a life that actually teaches something. Because the truth is, nobody's getting through this life without the scars. Everybody's going to go through something. Everybody's going to make mistakes. And we all have chapters that we literally wish we could rewrite. But the people who actually make an impact, and that's our God-given calling here, to step into your potential and make an impact. The people who are really doing that are the ones to decide that their story isn't something to hide. It's something to use. So if you're listening to this right now and something inside of you keeps whispering, "Man, I have a story too," then maybe it's time to stop sitting in the audience and start stepping into the arena, because somebody out there might need to hear exactly what you've been through. And if you've been thinking about starting a show, or you already have a podcast and you want to grow it, I did just launch a brand new podcast support group on Facebook. So get with me to get inside of that. It's a place for creators, storytellers, people who want to use their voice and their story to make an impact. So if that's you, please come join me. And who knows, maybe one day you'll be sitting in the hot seat of Tell Me Why You're Special and answering questions yourself. Again, thank you for your service, sir. It was an honor to have you here, and I'll see you guys next time.
Thank you.